Welcome to Behind the Headlines from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Thanks so much for tuning in. We're going to break today's show down a little bit differently than others. We've got two segments coming up, and we're going a little bit more in depth with each. Up first, producer Michael Meidenbauer sat down with investigative reporter John Faber this week. John has a new report out in conjunction with MedPage Today. The investigation found that more than 1 million reports of drug side effects were filed with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in 2015. This marks a fivefold increase since 2004. So what does all of this mean for consumers? Here's John and Michael with some answers.
I'm here with John Faber. Thanks for being on, John.
Thanks for having me.
And you've got another story in partnership with MedPage Today. Can you tell me about what you worked on?
Sure. We took a look at something known as the FDA's Adverse Events Reporting System. It's a database that allows people, whether you're a doctor, a patient, a drug company, to actually file a report in the event that a drug that you've used or that your patient has used causes a serious side effect. So this is a database that's really open to anybody, but it takes some crunching and analysis to kind of get to the numbers. So we took, when I say we, it was myself and Matt Wynn, who's a data reporter at MedPage Today, which we do these stories with, took a look at the system and what's happened to it over the years to see if there's been any sort of significant changes or trends. I guess the big thing that we found is that the number of reports that are being filed has increased fivefold over the last 12 years or so. So that in 2004, there were about 206,000 reports of what they call them adverse events, but they're essentially serious side effects. And in 2015, which is the last full year that the data was available, that had grown to 1.2 million. It looks like 2016 will be at least as much, if not more than 2015.
Can you tell me about these side effects? Like, are they serious? Are they not serious? Or is there a range to them?
There's a range. It can be anywhere from flatulence
all right,
to death and anything in between. Heart attacks, strokes, infections, fainting. I mean, you name it. We kind of focused on the more serious ones for the and usually people don't file reports unless it's something serious because why waste your time for something?
Right.
That's just not that important. So it's any kind of side effect that you might get from taking a drug.
Okay. And what sort of trends leapt out to you guys in terms of drugs or side effects?
Well, the big one was just the growth in the number of reports. For many years, the system had sort of been poo-pooed or derided for being kind of useless because there weren't a lot of reports being filed. There had been a study done once by the Government Accountability Board that found that probably 10% or less of all drug side effects actually get filed with this system. It's a voluntary system for patients and doctors. You know, for drug companies, they're required to file a report if they find out about one, but it's still largely a voluntary system. So a lot of the research community had sort of ignored this because it just didn't seem like there were enough reports there to really have a strong, a big enough numbers to do anything. But they've grown so much over the last decade or so that a lot of people now who follow this system think that it really does have some important meaning that can at least provide signals of dangers that might be coming from various drugs after they get onto the market. So, you know, we found that, some of the drugs that you see advertised on TV a lot, for instance, drugs, there's a whole bunch of drugs you probably have seen ads if you watch, like, network news at night. Drugs like Humira and Enbrel, these are drugs that treat autoimmune diseases like psoriasis and rheumatoid arthritis. Several of those drugs had pretty big numbers behind them. For instance, Humira, which is used to treat, I think, as many as 10 different autoimmune diseases, you know, like colitis and Crohn's and rheumatoid arthritis and psoriasis. Humira had looked like the greatest number of reports. There were probably, I think it was around 209,000 reports had been filed, reports of side effects since 2013, including 4,200 deaths. There was another drug that that was linked to a large number of deaths. It's, the name of the drug is Revlimid, and it's a cancer drug. It's used to treat multiple myeloma and a type of lymphoma. It is really kind of a an analog or a different version of a drug that was around back in the 1950s and early 1960s. It was one of the biggest scandals in all of medicine. That's a drug known as thalidomide. So Revlimid is essentially the thalidomide, but it's thalidomide was used to treat morning sickness in women who were pregnant, mostly in Europe. It had not gotten approved in the United States yet, but it led to thousands and thousands of babies being born with deformed legs and arms. Wow. It was a huge scandal. So the drug, you know, was banned for that purpose, but they later found that it actually can treat a couple of types of cancer. So it, I think it was around the mid-2000s it got back on the market as a cancer drug, but it's been linked to a large number of reports. I think there were close to 70,000 reports of side effects, including about 10,000 deaths. So these are numbers that basically are important because they give you the numerator, but what they don't do is give you the denominator. So you don't know, you know, for certainty if the, how dangerous these drugs are because you're only getting a part of the picture. But we wanted to try to provide, you know, the best picture that we could. And so this has been because the numbers of reports have been growing so much, we thought it was time to do a story.
Yeah. And what are the practical effects of all these reports? Like, what did the FDA do and what did the drug companies actually do with this data?
So what they should do is if they see a drug that is getting a lot of reports, there's another system that they can use. It's called Sentinel, and it allows them to go into like large healthcare systems like United Healthcare or Kaiser Permanente or some of these big insurance firms and actually try to look at files that look at prescriptions and cases of where people are seeing their doctors or being hospitalized to try to figure out if there is a real problem. So the adverse event system gives them the signal. These follow-up systems give them the ability to try to pinpoint it to find out if there's really a serious problem and whether something needs to be done about a drug after it gets on the market. And that's the main, you know, function for this system. I think there are some people who believe that there are a number of drugs that have gotten a lot of, you know, have a lot of adverse events connected with them, and they haven't been thoroughly followed up on to see if they're indeed really dangerous drugs.
What are some examples of those drugs? Are those, for instance, ones that people would recognize?
Yeah. Well, we didn't go into that into the story, but I'm kind of reluctant to say, we haven't fully fleshed out, whether there has been follow up or whether the FDA has, let's say, dropped the ball and not following up on them. So that's actually the topic for another story that we want to do. But some of the drugs that we looked at that had large numbers of reports filed, at least a few of them, it does not look like they have been followed up on yet.
So where'd you get the idea for doing this story?
Well, last year we had an ongoing series of stories called Illness Inflation. It was a look at a number of disorders, conditions of everyday life that had been turned into medical disorders, usually at the, you know, with the drug company involvement. These are conditions that some people question whether they're really medical disorders or diseases. And in doing this series, which just today won an award for the best explanatory journalism in a business journalism contest. But in doing this series, we used the FDA's adverse events database to look up drugs that treat some of these conditions, that these questionable conditions, and we kept finding, you know, interesting numbers and, you know, somewhat alarming numbers, and we decided And in doing that, we came to the conclusion that there seems to be a growing number of reports of adverse events. So we just downloaded the entire database. Matt Wynn, my colleague at MedPage Today, downloaded the entire database, and we took a look at what's happened to the system over the last decade or so.
Thanks so much to John and Michael for that report. To read John's story, grab Sunday's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It's also available online with additional features at jsonline.com/watchdog. If you're interested in reading his previous coverage, visit jsonline.com/illnessinflation. Coming up after the commercial break, there have been some changes to our opinions content in print. I'll chat with opinion editor Dave Haynes on the significance of those changes. Stay tuned for our talk.
I then realized that there's some evil things working here.
Oh, my God. Well, those are dark days for justice when you see that kind of conduct.
It was pure and simple, a setup.
I was raped in the first hour in prison.
Trust me, you're not going to want to miss 1 minute of Season 2 of Murder on the Space Coast. Subscribe now. It's free and available on iTunes, Google Play, on Stitcher Radio, or the SoundCloud apps.
Murder on the Space Coast returns Monday, with another episode rolling out Thursday. Don't miss a single minute of this season. Subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. As I mentioned before the break, there have been some changes to our opinions content. So what exactly are these changes, and what do they mean for our readers? Here's what opinion editor Dave Haynes had to say. I'm here with Dave Haynes, the editorial page editor. Maybe we should even look at changing your job title to just the editorial editor or the opinions editor. Is that
it is? Let me tell you a funny story here. I don't use editorial page editor a lot of times when I'm conversing with readers. I call myself an opinions editor or a commentary editor or something else, because in many ways we don't have an editorial board any longer. We have journalists who specialize in commentary, and they work on all the different platforms. So it's a good point.
And why do you feel that distinction is important between what maybe readers have traditionally known as an editorial board and journalists who specialize in commentary?
It's a broader sort of vision for what we do, and it fits better, in my view at least, on our digital platforms, where the traditional editorial, the traditional op-ed, the traditional letter to the editor, I mean, unless we can figure out ways to promote them and make them more appealing, they kind of, in many ways, go there to die. And so we have to figure out ways to take that traditional sort of work, not just cut and paste into our digital platforms, but enlivened in a way that makes them more appealing. So that's why I think that's important, that distinction.
And so there have been some changes recently in terms of the way that our editorial content fits into the print paper. How do you think that those print changes tie in with this new vision and new role for journalists who work in commentary?
Well, I felt pretty strongly that we needed to make a jump into digital. In fact, 3 or 4 years ago, I had a discussion with our former editor, Marty Kaiser, about what if commentary at the Journal Sentinel went all digital. And we weren't ready to do that for a number of reasons. And I think that was the right call. But we've recently cut back on the number of pages we offer in print. We still offer a pretty sizable presence on Sunday, but only one page then during the week, with some letters to the editor on other days. And I thought that was important for a number of reasons. It helped us to our team, our commentary team, it forced us to say, all right, how are we going to do this now? Whereas before, it was always a situation where it was harder to do with the resources we had when we were doing so much print production as well. So now we're in many ways a digital department within the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we're figuring out what that means. And I certainly don't have all the answers, Katie. I'm going to rely on you to help me figure this out.
You know, I do think it's an interesting thing, because you've got so many hot takes rolling around Twitter. You know, I can go on Twitter in the morning and I can see how everyone feels about a certain issue.
Yes.
And I feel like what happens is people get stuck a little bit in this red feed, blue feed. Have you heard of that?
I haven't.
Okay, so it is this thing. I believe it's by the Washington Post where you can look every day and it examines how a news story would appear on someone's Facebook page if they are liberal and tend to have liberal friends, mm-hmm. and if they're conservative and they tend to have conservative friends. Mm-hmm. And it's shocking the difference. You can really see how opinion and commentary it's a little hard to separate what the hard news and the opinions and the hot takes and the this and that. We saw a lot of that play out in the last election, and you know, you and Ernie have talked about that before on
this
show.
Yeah.
So I think it is going to be definitely a challenge for our opinions team because it's going to be a challenge of getting the information out there, connecting it to readers, and making it really clear where this information is coming from.
Yeah, and I think, too, we're in a very polarized state in Wisconsin, that, according to Craig Gilbert's reporting, maybe the most polarized metropolitan area in the country. And so we actually decided this a long time ago, that we had to represent all points of view on our platforms, conservative, liberal, and now populist, and libertarian, and others. And so we try to do that. And at least my vision for where we go online and on our digital platforms is that we do the exact same thing, only do it in ways that's more appealing for people who are consuming news and commentary digitally. And I don't know exactly what form that takes at this point. As Herman Cain once said in our newsroom, I have these ideas twirling around in the back of my head, but they haven't taken a full form yet.
So if someone wanted to engage or find commentary on local issues, where would you direct them to do so?
Well, you should definitely come to JS Online, to our commentary pages. And often our commentary or that of our contributors is on the homepage. But the other thing that we plan to do in early April is launch a newsletter. To begin with, it will be weekly, although I hope we can do it more often than that. And that will be, at this point, sort of an, in case you missed it, here's what we've been doing. And here's a couple of things you should look forward to in the next few days. From us. And one of the things I think could be helpful there is print readers who may not be as interested in going to their phone for information, for example, might be okay with getting an email from us that summarizes what has been going on. And so that's part of the idea there, at least. So there's that. And certainly we're all over Twitter and Facebook every day having conversations, asking questions of people, and then taking those answers that we get from readers back to our digital platforms and writing more content. We've got a blog that we rechristened Real Time, and the newsletter will be called Real Time Opinion. And on Real Time, we're just hoping to have a couple of posts there a day about something really provocative that we saw we think you should know about.
So traditionally, when people wanted to interact with the staffers on the opinion team, they could make a phone call, write a letter to the editor. And of course, we are still running letters to the editors. But how do you encourage people to interact with you now that we are prioritizing our digital platforms?
Well, we do it in a whole bunch of ways. So, for example, David Shribman, who's the editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, has this great essay about how all the institutions in the country are under siege. That's coming in our Sunday print edition this week. But I wrote a blog post yesterday summarizing that with a short video that summarized what he was saying and then asking the question, so what do you think? What are three things we can do right now to help bring people together? And I'm hoping we get some response to that. And so we're instead of waiting for people to come to us, which is what we've traditionally done, we're using the convening power of the news organization, which is substantial in this market, to go to them by through blog posts like that, through social media, through Facebook. We've done a fair amount of Facebook work, through live chats where we're available to take questions, or where we have folks from the community come in who have something to say about an issue and we interview them. Again, Katie, I'm hoping you have other ideas for us.
I'm sure we'll be talking.
that will help us do this even better.
Well, and I think
I would just add, it is exhilarating, it's fun, it's exciting, and it's also deeply frightening for us as journalists.
And I think that's an important thing for us to communicate to our audience that maybe we don't often do well, that journalism is going through changes, and we're aware of that. We are in it every single day, and we are trying our best to make sure that we are appealing to audiences across geographic locations, across different, you know, race, ethnicities, genders, political views, but also people who use different mediums. And it's becoming increasingly difficult to stay ahead of the curve, you know, to stay, but that it is something we are actively working to do through things like this.
You bet.
There are pushes.
You bet. And I'd just like to piggyback on something you said about reaching out to different audiences. We clearly in the commentary area have three deficits in our readership based on just what I've seen anecdotally that we have to work on. One is women. I think we're better than we were at that, at getting women to write for us and to engage with us, but that's still a problem. People of color and millennials. And so I refuse to believe on the millennials question, for example. I refuse to believe that millennials are not interested in policy issues that matter to them. I know they are. I think it's more a matter of us not knowing how to talk with them using technology and the media as it exists today. And so there again, that's an unknowable. I don't know the answer to that exactly, but I think that we can figure it out.
I agree. I also think one of the things that you're doing that we should talk about are in-person events to try to go and explore that concept of listening to your audience. So for people who haven't heard of these before, can you talk about what the editorial team is doing?
You bet. So we are working with WUWM, Public Radio in Milwaukee, on a series of events that we call Across the Divide. And the idea here is to bring people together who might not necessarily talk to one another and have a discussion. We have a couple of folks at the head table with our moderators, one from the radio station, one from the Journal Sentinel, and we have a discussion for 15 or 20 minutes, and then we open it up to our audience. And the real part of the show is that, is to have the audience connect with both our experts and our moderators and us and just have a discussion. We sensed during the election and right after that there was a real hunger for moderated, thoughtful, civil discussion. And so we're trying to capitalize on that in a sense by offering it. We've had one. We have another one planned in May on immigration. Venue and time to be announced soon. And then I think we'll take a break over the summer and come back in the fall and do a series of two. Is a series two or does it have to be three? It's only going to be two, so we'll call it a series on something in the fall. But the idea here is to just, you know, and get out and meet people. We're also doing other things. I'm having a meetup with some students at UWM in late March to hear about what they're interested in. I'm going to do the same thing through Marquette and hopefully through Radio Milwaukee as well. And Radio Milwaukee, if you're listening to this, I'm going to be calling you. We're good at getting out and talking to people in traditional venues like Milwaukee Rotary, which is a great organization. But, you know, they don't have many millennials at Milwaukee Rotary. So we have to do more.
All right, perfect. Well, that's all the questions I have. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks, Katie.
Editor Dave Haynes has written about these changes and their intent. To find that column as well as other pieces by Dave and his crew, visit jsonline.com/opinion. We'll end today's show there. Thanks so much for listening. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell, signing off for the week. Join me next week for more behind-the-scenes information from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.